KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Lower Haight.
Tenderloin.
Half Moon Bay.
Sutter Heights.
I live in the Union Square.
Tender Knob.
I live in Richmond, California.
Coming up, how one art project is connecting San Francisco residents with refugees from across the world.
Are you guys hoping to go back to Syria, or are you going to try and go to Europe?
For sure, Syria.
Then a man incarcerated for over two decades re-enters society with a newfound friendship with his parents.
I always tell them that on January 16, 1996, I kissed my mother on her forehead and told her I'd see her later. I haven't been home since.
And we'll hear ghost stories from the chapel, a music venue in the Mission with a somber past.
This is where the bodies used to be.
Yeah.
Stay tuned. Cross Currents is coming up. So listen to this number, 5,629,700. That's the number of people who fled Syria and registered with the United Nations as refugees. They're seeking refuge from a brutal civil war that's killed an estimated 500,000 people since 2011. And where survivors will live is an open question. They're not as welcomed here in the U.S. as they used to be. In 2015, 31 governors opposed giving Syrian refugees safe haven in their states. This year, the U.S. is accepting fewer refugees from anywhere than any time in the last 40 years. Now, hearing about all of this from afar, it can be easy to get lost in the numbers. So how can you connect with real people who are living around the world? One way is with a shipping container, a Skype account, and a little gold paint. And it's happening right now. We'll hear where it's at in a minute, but first we'll get the backstory as told a few years ago by KLW's Hannah Kingsley Ma.
Two young trombone players are performing a duet inside a shipping container in an emptied lot in Hayes Valley. Musicians Harry Gonzalez and Brett Wyatt are from the San Francisco Symphony Youth Orchestra, and they address their audience through the screen in front of them.
So we just wanted to show you a little bit of how the art culture is really prevalent here in San Francisco. It's more than just tech.
An interpreter from the UN on the other end translates for the two Syrian teenage girls who are listening intently to this concert through a screen of their own, in a refugee camp over 7,000 miles away. The sun has just risen in San Francisco as the trombonists finish, as if their horn music is issuing in the day. In Jordan, it's evening, around 5 p.m. The trombone players ask what the girls' names are through the translator.
I am Aman.
Firbat
and Aman.
If their voices sound a little muffled, well, remember, that's because we're in a shipping container. And this conversation is as unusual as its setting. Close to 80,000 Syrians live in the Za'atari refugee camp, including more than 40,000 children and teens. Amat and Marvat, who are both 17, have lived there since 2013.
Yes, thank you for all your talents. We really admired what you played, and we admired what the talents you have.
Thank you. Hopefully it's not too loud.
They're talking to each other thanks to an international public art installation by Shared Studios called Portals. In 2014, creator Amar Bakshi came up with the idea to place gold shipping containers like this one all across the world, in Cuba and Afghanistan and Honduras and Iran and Mexico, and encourage strangers in different countries to talk to each other over Skype. He says he was inspired in part by the way we use technology, or rather, the way that we don't.
We have Facebook and Twitter, Skype, but we use it to generally speak to our own family, share with our own friends.
Sitting on a nearby bench, Bakshi tells me he hopes that these encounters are purposeless. The conversation isn't tied to any specific agendas. The motive, if any, is to get a sense of other people's daily lives. People are sent in with only one prompt.
What would make the day a good day?
So far, Portals has facilitated 7,000 conversations in 7 countries. And though it's not the main goal, Bakshi believes the conversations in the portals could lead to very real outcomes, especially in a city like San Francisco.
There's a lot of excitement in all our portal locations to connect to San Francisco because it is, and it's imagined as, a place of incredible entrepreneurship, world-changing ideas, incredible financial resources, and really smart people here. Our portal locations, as people know, are similarly talented. They're not as well financially resourced, but have incredible amounts to contribute and do.
He sees the portals as a platform for a budding micro-economy, or a stage for musicians and artists to demonstrate their gifts, or even an international classroom. Another group here this morning is from the nearby French International High School. They have 20 minutes and a list of questions they want to ask, filling the silences with their curiosity.
And what does a typical day look like for you?
In the morning, I wake up and go to school. Then after school, I go to a youth empowerment center. We read to other students, and we're also establishing a new project for a girls' committee in the camp.
At times, it's awkward. It's hard to know when to speak up.
So are you guys hoping to be able to?
Still, they share their goals and aspirations.
What would you like to do later in life?
I want to have a big role in my community, not only a housewife.
And begin to probe the ways in which their lives are drastically different.
Where do you guys, do you have a sort of home at the camp, or do you sleep? Where do you sleep?
We sleep in caravans. We have caravans and we sleep in.
When it's over, the students say goodbye and file out into the deep blue hues of the early morning to debrief. I spoke to students Sophia Clark and Oriane Bahi.
This is quite interesting because it's a different perspective versus textbooks. Instead, we talk to some real refugees.
Yeah, we actually had a really long list of questions, but you don't know what the limit is and what will hurt them in a way, like the type of questions. So, and there was a bit, we were kind of shy. It's kind of, yeah, I mean, it was a big group, so it was difficult to get in your question.
After the students are done reflecting, they gather up their things and shift back into their normal routine. Outside the portal is a Burning Man art temple, a artisanal ice cream stand, and a truck that sells really expensive juice. The dissonance between this environment and that of a Syrian refugee camp feels pretty stark. Bakshi, the creator of portals, says that uncomfortable feeling, it's a good thing.
How do people deal with the fact that they go in there for 20 minutes and see someone's life concerns are radically different than their own? Well, it's going to happen either way. That's happening whether or not you know it.
I tried to get in touch with Mervat and Ahmet later, but I couldn't get a hold of them. So I never learned what they took away from this exchange. But the conversation I heard was still pretty remarkable, if only because without a project like Portals, it probably never would have happened. In San Francisco, I'm Hannah Kingsley Ma for Cross Currents.
That story originally aired in 2015. A gold-painted portal is currently stationed at Oakland International High School. You can book time to talk with people around the world. Tomorrow, it's Conversations with Gaza. Find more information at kelw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KELW News. I'm Henat Baba. Now we'll get another rare glimpse into prison life, this time with a story from San Quentin Radio.
San Quentin Radio, bringing you informative educational stories from the inside out.
In order to make something grow, you got to own a little dirt.
You don't tell, you see what goes on.
Because I like to be free. I like to move about the land.
You could hear a pin drop, and all of a sudden you heard this.
Cleo Kloman spent over two decades behind bars for murder. He grew up in a two-parent household and had dreams of playing professional baseball. After a rocky relationship with his father, he lost his passion for the sport and found a new pursuit, the streets. It ultimately cost him his freedom. But throughout the years of his incarceration, he was able to reconnect with his father and regain his love for baseball from within the walls of San Quentin.
So my family life was a blessing and a curse. I had both of my parents as a blessing. My mother and my father was there. The curse was that there was addiction in my household, particularly by my father. He was an alcoholic, he was a drug user, and he was a womanizer. And that played a big toll in my household. One thing that I realized my dad loved was sports. So that was my number one priority. It's like I had to excel in sports in order to get my dad to smile. When we were outside our home, we was in the community playing sports, I seen my dad light up like the brightest star in the world. And when I watched him watch me play, I could see how proud he was. And I did everything possible to keep that proudness that he wore on his face. My dad tried his best, but he changed. He became a different person. In the home, he was a monster. Outside the home, he was my magical creature, my best friend, the person that I enjoyed being around. And it was just feeling like I was living two different lifestyles. I didn't know how to deal with what I was going through. I didn't even understand what I was going through. I knew I felt something. I felt a sense of fear. I felt a sense of nervousness, but I couldn't understand where it was coming from. I didn't understand what to do with it. I thought, you know, things that I did was gonna change the feeling, was gonna allow me to build that relationship with my father. But nothing I did inside the home worked. I started going outside my home to find things to feel good. And one thing that I started doing was smoking weed, drinking, having sex more often. And these things were allowing me to feel better about myself. But I realize now it was an escape. It was a place where I didn't have to deal with what I was dealing with at home, which was the fear and the nervousness of what my dad is gonna do next. I eventually went to the streets and got away from baseball and lost my focus on my hopes and dreams. What the streets did was it painted a picture like it was all fine and dandy and it was gonna be much greater than baseball, but all along, the darkness overcame me. So I started committing crimes for money, I started robbing for money, and thinking money was gonna solve all my problems. But what I lacked was the education of money. So the things that I was robbing for, I was just spending it on frivolous stuff, clothes, jewelry, drugs, parties. And when that money was spent, I went right back to what I knew, how to go rob and take from others. On January 16, 1996, it was just like any other ordinary day for me. I was gonna go commit a robbery for money so I could support my habit and my greed. That was one of the choices that has changed my life forever. I made a choice to go commit a robbery, and in the process of robbing a grocery store manager, he stood up for his right to live, and he was murdered for that. I am responsible for Mr. Soho being murdered, and I received 25 years to life in prison with the possibility of parole. So 2011, right after Thanksgiving holidays, I was transferred to San Quentin. And as driving up on a bus to R&R, I was looking out the window and I seen something that just made me smile and brought this feeling to my heart, my mind, my soul. I could feel it all the way to my feet. And it was just a baseball field. And I remember walking down the stairs, walking past the tables, and just coming down smelling the grass. But when I took that first step on the grass in left field, everything went silent. All I could remember was the texture of the grass underneath my feet. It seemed like I could smell the dirt. I could smell the crowd, the snack stands. It was like a transcending feeling. And somebody hit the ball to me, and I remember the sound of the crack. It just said, crack. And I'm watching the ball fly in the air, and it's coming closer, closer. I got underneath it, perfect form, perfect technique. And I heard that ball hit the glove, and then at that moment, it was no stopping me. All I kept thinking about was that little kid running around the bases, hitting the balls in the gap, clapping hands with my teammates. And I thought about my dad, you know, how he would feel if he could just come here and watch me play again. My dad is my best friend. And I realized something. If I hate my dad, I hate myself. If I love myself, I love my dad. Because I am my dad. I have the same qualities as my dad. My dad is compassionate. My dad is humble. My dad is outgoing. My dad is loving. My dad is a people's person. And those are the same qualities and characteristics that I display. And I learned that from him.
Cleo Kloman was released on May 19th, 2017, and returned to his home in L.A. That story was produced by Greg Eskridge for San Quentin Radio. It's our radio training program at the prison, supported by the California Arts Council with funding from the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. All content is approved by an information officer. You can hear more stories from San Quentin Radio at our website, KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Okay, it's about to get dark out. The perfect time on Halloween for a ghost story. In the late 1800s, San Francisco started to get crowded. To make more room, the city outlawed burials, and it moved all of its cemeteries south. Tacoma. The business of funerals, however, stayed in San Francisco. The Southern Pacific Railroad cut through the Mission on its way to Tacoma, and so new mortuaries started opening up along Valencia Street, including in the building that's now the chapel. Today, the chapel is a lively music venue, but many people who work there say its history as a mortuary lingers. KALW's Zoe Ferrigno has that story.
It's a quiet afternoon at the chapel. The bar hasn't opened yet, and I'm standing in between the kitchen and the patio, looking up at a big, rusty piece of metal on a wall. It looks like it could be an old wagon spoke or just a weird piece of art, but in reality...
That's the crank right there, where they used to hoist the bodies up after they went through the proper process to be buried. They would be hoisted up using this crank.
Paul Chalker handles PR for the chapel, and he's giving me a tour of the building. He says where we're standing right now used to be a garage where bodies were loaded onto the train. Joining us is former chapel bartender Javi Castro. He leads us down a flight of stairs into the basement wine cellar. It's small, cold, and pitch black.
And then at 2:30 in the morning, nobody else here. Super dead quiet. You'd never ever want to be here more than 10 seconds.
This is where the bodies used to be.
Yeah.
Javi says when he first started working at the chapel, some guys on the cleaning crew told him they thought the building was haunted. After an experience down here in the cellar, Javi became a believer.
The door just slammed shut on me. And I opened the door, there's nobody there. And then I got super, super spooked, like all this weird, like energy up my spine. I was just like, I knew I was not alone at that time. And that's when it started. I was like, all right, this is for real.
After that night, Javi says he'd often see figures out of the corner of his eye, but they'd vanish when he turned to get a better look. It was like something was there, but always just out of view. But for others, the presence of something ghostly has been a little less subtle.
I would be in the kitchen really, really early in the morning, and there would be nobody else in that building.
Elaine Osuna is a chef who helped open the chapel. She tells me that she would often see the shadowy figure of a woman in a hallway by the kitchen.
No, it's like she's in like a white dress, and her hair is in a way, like I can see how she's styled, like her hair is in a way kind of like an old-fashioned bun.
Elaine noticed something else unique about the woman.
The smell of roses was always with her.
Elaine called her the Rose Lady.
You're gonna think I'm nuts, but I always felt like she was kind of keeping me company. And so I know it sounds nutty, but she kind of made me feel like I wasn't by myself in a good way.
But if Elaine is nuts, so is everyone I talked to at the chapel.
There was a shelf, like a metal shelf with all sorts of beer bottles on it. And one time a bottle just basically shot straight at me, like horizontally off the shelf, and then just stopped in midair and just dropped to the ground.
That's former barback Rick Altieri. And here's Erica Wesley. She manages the venue's box office.
I've seen things in the bathrooms, like kind of like shadowy figures. Like it's usually standing behind me, and like when I look in the mirror, it's like behind me. One time I had someone tap me on the shoulder, and there was no one there.
It turns out, though, that sometimes the creepiest things happened at the chapel when no one was around to see them. A few years ago, one of the security cameras captured something late at night. You can look the video up online. In it, you can see the area where the old body crank is. The last member of the cleaning crew leaves, and all of a sudden, a little girl appears, wearing a white dress and no shoes. She darts into the room and then runs back out. Erica was one of the first people to see the video.
And when we went back through all the footage, we looked at every camera the entire night, and there's nobody there that's wearing anything like that. There was another camera that would have picked up her movements once she left, and that camera shows nothing.
After news of the video spread, more people came forward, sharing sightings of the girl. People at the chapel started calling her Valencia, after the street. I ask a few people whether they're sure Valencia is really a ghost, or if there might be another explanation. But everyone seems convinced. As Erica told me, when it comes to believing in ghost stories, the chapel is a pretty persuasive place.
I don't know, man, it's turned people. Like, we've had people that work there that don't believe in ghosts at all. You know, people that are in their 20s and 30s and have never believed in any of that stuff.
But after working at the chapel, now they're believers. On Valencia Street, I'm Zoe Ferrigno for Cross Currents.
That was the last of three Bay Area ghost stories produced in honor of Halloween. You can find all three at our website, klw.org. That is, if you dare. Today's Cross Currents team includes Jack-O-Lantern Darden, Nina Gensler Devil, Howl a Deluna, Sarah Ghost, Fang Jilla Johnston, Mummy McKay, Lisa Gorehouse, Marissa Ortega Witch, Spookwin, and Squeelie Wurchafter. Our engineers are Tarek Frankenstein, Scare Krolens, and Gabe Goblin. Skeleton Adil is our content manager. Our managing editor is David Boo. Ben Daphne is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by San Francisco-based Spooky Mansion. They'll play Sunday night at the Masonic. Doors open at 8 o'clock. Happy Halloween, everybody. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Bala.